Thank you very much. Just one page, double-sided. Jonathan, thank you so much for hosting. And Michael, thank you for helping to set this up as well. And I'm grateful to everybody for coming. A little bit of background. Jonathan read out the bio, and thank you very much for doing that. That saves me some work, because now you know who I am. But just to explain a little bit about what brings me here in particular, I am with the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzion Beit Midrash Zichron Dov, which Jonathan mentioned. That is basically a rabbinic training program in which we take rabbinical students from Yeshiva University, which is New York-based, as well as Torah Mitzion, an organization in Israel, and my job is to teach them over a period of a couple of years and train them for the rabbinate. We're based in a boys' high school, which some of you are probably familiar with, Yeshivat Or Chaim, that's in the Clinton Park area. And so we also work with the high school students, giving classes there, largely informally. And we also have a program with university students, in which university students come study with us in our Beit Midrash, in our study hall. When I'm not involved with those things, so I teach classes around the community on topics particularly that relate to the ideals of Yeshiva University and Torah Mitzion, meaning an embrace of the world and knowledge of the world and how the Torah fits in with our lives in general. And I'll talk more about that as we go through this topic that we're going to see today, as well as the religious Zionism of Torah Mitzion, which is less directly relevant to the topic today, despite the mention of OPEC. So that's what brings me here today, to speak about the ethics of OPEC driving down prices to kill competition. And I have to give credit to an organization out of New Jersey called Beis Havad, where I actually saw an email from them where they asked this question of, if you're driving down prices to damage your competition, is that acceptable ethically within Judaism? They went one way with the topic, I'm taking it a little bit of a different direction, but I did see that they addressed this first. So you can see that this is actually being recorded, audio as well as video, both will be available online, and if you want the link to that afterwards, I'll be glad to provide it. My email address is at the top of the source sheet, so you can see it there. Also, I'd be grateful in general for feedback afterwards. This is the first time I've tackled this topic. I do a lot of business ethics topics around the community, but this is the first time I've done this one. So, without further ado then, by way of background, today's oil economy has multiple merchants, multiple sellers. You have the OPEC cartel, which currently consists of 12 countries. Contrary to popular impression, it is not only in the Middle East. It includes countries in Africa. It includes countries in South America. But you have this cartel of 12 countries. You also have, of course, Canada as an oil-selling nation, the United States now as well, various other countries. Israel, indeed, has its own oil production at this point. But each one determines its own production levels and the price at which it's going to sell oil. In the last 10 years or so, with oil prices high and new technologies becoming available for finding oil and refining it, new oil suppliers have sprung up seeking to make money on the market. 2014, the price of oil began to drop, both due to new suppliers and due to a drop in global demand with the growth of new technologies that are slowly taking the place of some of the standard uses of oil. So in November of 2014, with prices dropping, OPEC meets for a regular meeting. Now, OPEC produces, I'm told, based on the articles I've read, 40% of the world's oil is coming through OPEC. So they have one of their regular meetings in which they're going to discuss production levels and whether to raise production, lower production. The assumption the world makes is that they're going to lower their production because prices have been falling. You reduce your supply, and therefore the prices will go back up, and everybody who is producing oil will be happy, while those of us who simply buy the oil at the gas station will be less happy. That's what normally happens. But it's not what happened this time. In the 1980s, there was a period where oil was dropping. And at that point, Saudi Arabia said, we're going to cut production, and OPEC cut production, and that was their strategy. But this time they said, no, we're going to maintain our current production levels for at least the next 6 months. And the result is that the price has plummeted since. There are numerous articles you can find online that discuss this in greater detail. I gave you just a sentence from one in the first source on your sheets, why oil prices keep falling, from the website Vox. At its big meeting last November, OPEC did nothing. Saudi Arabia didn't want to give up market share, meaning they're afraid if they cut production, that just means people are going to buy elsewhere, and refused to cut production in the hopes that lower prices would help throttle the U.S. shale boom. One of the major new technologies you for sure are familiar with is the whole fracking procedure, the procedure of drawing oil out of shale and the oil sands. And they felt if these new competitors who need to invest heavily in infrastructure are not getting a good price for their oil, they won't have the ability to invest anymore in this, and they'll have to cash in their chips. They're going to fold. And then with the competition out of the way, we can elevate our production or lower production, whatever we choose. But bottom line is we are back in control of prices. That's the general concept. So the question is driving down prices to reduce competition an acceptable strategy? Now, I'm an American, and as an American, I come from a society that is joyfully capitalist, which says that if you didn't break the laws, then what's there to ask? Why is there even a question about this? The law doesn't say I can set whatever price I want, I can set whatever production I want. Therefore, it's ethical. However, within Judaism, it doesn't quite work that way. And the reason it doesn't work that way is because from a Jewish perspective, all of our activities have religious elements as well. Even the apparently most secular activity has some religious element to it. So, for example, I speak to a lot of medical groups and doctors about medical ethics, and the question of, well, what will we say religiously? Because healing somebody is itself a religious activity. I also speak a lot to groups of lawyers. I'm giving a class on Sunday morning on the unethical client, and what do you do if you suspect your client is perpetrating some kind of a scam. It's actually accountant related also. Somebody, if you're doing taxes for somebody, or you're working for a business, and you suspect that what the information they're giving you is fraudulent, and they're asking you just to process it and ignore the question of how they came to these numbers, so what is your responsibility? I know that accountants have their own code, and lawyers have the Law Society code. From a Jewish perspective, the practice of law is also a religious activity, and therefore there are religious issues that come up as well. And the same thing is true when you're dealing with commerce. Commerce also is, engaging in business is also a religious activity as part of your interaction with society, and therefore it's governed by certain principles too. So the question is, from a Jewish perspective, is this acceptable? For me to say, I'm going to keep my production level high in order to lower the prices in order that my competition should not be able to survive in business. Is that an acceptable strategy? I'm going to open the question first to you. What would you say? Yes, no, maybe, with something to support it beyond just, you know, I think yes or I think no.
You have to look after yourself first.
Okay, you have to look after yourself first, Harry says. And so on that basis, you'd be allowed to. Okay.
I would think that you have to distinguish that if I reduce prices where I may be profitable versus my competition, who may not be as efficient as me, are not profitable, that may be a scenario that I would say it needs to be distinguished amongst the scenarios you're contemplating.
Okay, so what would you say for such a scenario? Where
I would think it's if I'm still profitable and then I'm still doing within the confines of best efforts, I would say yes. I think that's acceptable.
If I can put it in slightly different words, if the reason why I'm able to survive in this environment is because I do a better job, essentially, of managing whatever the resources are and marketing it, is that the...
Well, yes, look, it costs Venezuela $117 a barrel to extract oil.
Okay.
It costs Saudi Arabia, depending on which way they do it, anywhere between $35 and $50 a barrel. So that's to give context to your scenario.
Right. So that's light for Venezuela.
Yeah.
Or
for Canada as well. Canada's probably about 80. It's by country by country.
Okay. So according to that, in other words, this is a free market. And if they'll do a better job, they'll do fine. And if not, to whatever circumstances or their abilities or whatever it is, then that's their problem. And that's certainly an approach to it along the lines of you look out for yourself, they'll look out for themselves, let them go into another line of work if this doesn't work for them.
What about the idea of
of the fact that lower prices has a wider benefit to the general community.
Good. Third point, right? In addition to looking out for myself, and in addition to the argument of that's business, we have the fact that when prices are lower, the general community benefits. Right? Some producers may go out of business, but on the other hand, the consumer who's going up to the gas tank and says, I can't believe this, the price hasn't been this low since before they put the HST on gas, says, this is amazing, I'm very happy about this. Now, does it really benefit society as a whole? I saw a head shake over there, right, from Jeffrey.
Yeah, well, I think what we're going to see is that the Canadian government, because of their drop in revenue, is either going to put some sort of tax on gas, or they'll have to make up the deficit elsewhere.
Right. So there are ancillary effects, right, direct and indirect, on this situation. Absolutely true. I mean, the Canadian dollar plummeting is, as I understand it, and I'm not, you know, an economist, but I listen to the radio, and so I know what they tell me, is associated with the falling price of oil. So let's look at this and take this further in terms of Jewish sources. Now, I'm going to stipulate something which isn't fair, but it has to be stipulated or things become unmanageably complicated, which is, we're dealing with a question technically of whether Jewish laws and requirements apply to non-Jewish merchants or non-Jewish customers for whom, you know, does the Jewish system, you know, pertain or apply at all? No. So what I'm going to pretend is that OPEC is Jewish and that all their consumers are Jewish, and therefore the question of what you are able to do or are not able to do actually has full application, as opposed to going through source by source and saying, well, this issue would apply and this issue would not apply, which makes things really unmanageable for the time frame that we have. A little bit of background in general on the development of Jewish law, just to explain how we're going to go through this. You're probably familiar with biblical text. We have the basic text, called in Hebrew the Chumash, which the Jews received when they are traditionally from going from Egypt into the land that is called Canaan, that ultimately becomes Israel. We have the five books, followed by prophets who are added thereafter. And it's accompanied by a verbal explanation of the biblical text. That verbal explanation is passed down generation to generation. It evolves with conversation. But eventually it is written down. And the reason it's written down is primarily because of two concerns. Number one, people forget. And number two, because of persecution. When you hit the Roman period, it's already been passed down for many centuries. When you hit the Roman period 2,000 years ago, the Romans decide that the reason these pesky Jews keep rebelling against their empire is because they have this ideology of their own and religious identity of their own. And so what we need to do is squash that. And then they'll assimilate much more easily. And so what they do is they put a ban on the study of Torah, of Jewish tradition, in which there's a death penalty for studying it or teaching it. They further create a ban on ordaining rabbis. And the ban is, in the event that a rabbi is ordained, we will execute the members of the rabbinical court that ordained him, we will execute the ordainee, and we will also execute the Jewish population of the nearest town. Once they do that, that puts a halt to the ability to transmit a verbal tradition, because verbal tradition, by definition, requires two people in a room together, and they can't do that, and it requires teachers, and suddenly you don't have them. So, for both because of the issue of forgetting and because of the issue of persecution, they decide that they're going to write down these verbal explanations. They first write down an outline of law called the Mishnah that is finalized in the beginning of the 3rd century Common Era in the city of Tzipori, which is right near the Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee in Israel. And then an expansion of that, a discussion of that, is written down over the next couple of centuries. It is what is called Gemara. Together, Mishnah plus Gemara is called Talmud. So that's concluded by the middle of the 6th century. I am, you know, condensing what is obviously much, much, much more intricate. The Talmud itself presents us with law, but it's in the form of discussions. So what you then have following that are responsa, in which rabbis are asked, what do I do about this, what do I do about that? And that evolves over a period of centuries with this great responsa literature. In the 12th century, end of the 12th century, Rabbi Moses Maimonides writes a work of law that seeks to codify law. It's called Mishneh Torah, and that's one of his major works, one of his major contributions, is this work of law. It is followed by other commentaries and those who disagree, and ultimately the Code of Jewish Law is written at the end of the 15th century, beginning of the 16th century. Two authors to it. The first author is Rabbi Yosef Karo, writing in Israel. He was Turkish originally, but then he moved to Israel. And then there's another part of it that's written by Rabbi Moshe Isserles, living in Poland. And this is important, and the reason I'm stressing it is because the main document is written from a Sephardic perspective, the Jews who lived in North Africa, the Jews who lived in maybe some of the southern European countries as well, nearer to the Mediterranean. And then you have Rabbi Isserles adding a part that reflects a tradition of Ashkenazi Jews, which were Jews from Germany, as well as points east, like Poland, where Rabbi Isserles was. That's the code of Jewish law. And the reason why I'm giving you this is because what we're going to be doing is focusing on sources that come from the Talmud, or Maimonides with his code of law, or the code of Jewish law, the Shulchan Aruch, as it's called in Hebrew, that I just mentioned. Those are the three main texts that we're going to draw on. And I'll try to explain more as we go, but that's just... the basic sort of framework. You have the Talmud, which is codified in, again, finalized in the 6th century Common Era. Maimonides in the 12th century, trying to put it into a code form instead of a discussion form. And then the Code of Jewish Law, which comes along in the 16th century, beginning of the 16th, and their goal is to take the ideas of Maimonides and his laws, along with those who disagreed with him, and condense it into a work that will present for a Jew a practical resource. You want to know what to do? Open the book and see. You follow? I know that that's a lot of information, but I'll pick out points that are necessary as we go through it. None of it is going to be on the final. Just know that. Okay. Generally speaking, as we look at a question like the OPEC question, we look for precedent. Sometimes precedents will disagree with each other, but we always look for precedent. Where has this come up in the past? So the question now is, how has this ever come up within Jewish history? This issue of lowering prices or allowing prices to drop in order to kill competition. And the answer is it came up primarily in two periods in Jewish history. The first in ancient Rome, and the second one, much more recently, 16th to 19th centuries. In the world of ancient Rome, you had fixed maximum prices. In Hebrew, they were called a shahar. And you weren't allowed to go over that price. That exists from the beginning of the Common Era till the fall of Rome. It was a constant, and they were forever playing with it, trying to get exactly the right balance. But I gave you an example from source number three, number two, the Edict of Diocletian fixing maximum prices. But basically, without getting into too great detail, Diocletian is the emperor. He's considered one of the wiser emperors that the Roman Empire had. In the end of the 3rd century, beginning of the 4th century, he's dealing with economic collapse, and he decides the way to deal with it is to fix maximum prices for goods as well as services. You're not allowed to charge more. He feels that more control is going to help. So Jewish merchants, like everybody, are dealing in an environment in which there is a fixed price they are allowed to charge, beyond which you can't go. And there is, in that environment, concern about somebody undercutting somebody else. Somebody else is selling at that maximum rate. I'm going to go into business and undercut him. What are the ramifications of that? Is that okay? That's the first time this comes up in a big way in Jewish history. The second time it comes up is, as I said, in the 16th and 19th centuries, when governments would sell licenses for businesses, and in particular for alcohol. I brought you in source number three. I'm not going to read it aloud because everybody here can read English. The Parliament of England decrees that bill from 1551. The Parliament of England decrees licensing for taverns. Now, in the context of the decree itself, it sounds like it's a moral thing. They're upset about things that are going on, the type of behavior going on in a tavern, and they're only going to license establishments in which people are properly behaved. However, historians say that wasn't the real issue. That doesn't come up for centuries thereafter. The real issue for the parliament is simply to protect the businesses of people who were friends with the parliamentarians, who didn't want that anybody should be able to open up a tavern as they chose, so we're going to sell licenses, right? Liquor control, sound familiar at all, right? Ontario? The same concept going on. That's actually the first one, is in 1551, the Alehouses Act. So we find in the Jewish community, quite a few Jews were in the business of selling alcohol, running taverns. And so you would have problems in which someone would purchase a license to be able to sell, and then somebody else would come in and purchase a license to be able to sell and undercut the first, damaging the value of his license. And so the question would arise, is that in fact something you're allowed to do? Clear so far? Interrupt at any point, please. I'm inviting interruption. So, the oil market is a little bit different from the Roman period, in the sense that there is no sha'ar today. There's no fixed price that can be imposed on another. Within the cartel, there may be. But there's no fixed price that OPEC is able to say to everybody else, you have to charge this, or that an external third body is going to be able to impose on oil producers. So it's not quite the same. Nonetheless, the answers that are given in those cases provide insight into Jewish economic philosophy, which should help us to address this question today. Now, it's not, I should emphasize, the ethical question is not unique to Jewish thought. Secular economists ask the ethical question also. I brought you on your sheet from Alfred William Coates, although I did add an extra O in the title of his book. But the classical economists and economic policy, he's summarizing the position of Adam Smith. When he writes, men could safely be trusted to pursue their own self-interest without undue harm to the community, not only because of the restrictions imposed by the law, but also because they were subject to built-in restraint derived from morals, religious custom, and education. So there is built-in, hopefully within society, a restraint that isn't about the law. And that's what we're going to see within Jewish sources. So let's we're now like 15 minutes in, and we haven't actually opened a Jewish source. So let's do that. Source number 5 is my starting point. For most of them, I brought you the Hebrew along with the English, but in the interest of space, I did not bring it for source number 5. But source number 5 is a key source. This is a passage out of the Talmud dealing with competition. I first bring you the Mishnah and then the Gemara. First the earlier law and then the debate on it. And here's the source. Rabbi Yehuda said in number 5, a store owner may not distribute parched grain and nuts to children, for this would accustom them to come to him. Okay? This is my business practice. I don't sell candy. I sell clothing. But I know that if I can get the kids to come around to my store, then the parents will be there with them, and I will be able to sell them clothing. So the first view, the view of Rabbi Yehuda, is you're not allowed to do that. That is unfair competition, he says. But the sages permit. The sages say, you're allowed to do this. This is acceptable, and if you don't like it, in the event that you don't like it, they say, you know what? You should start distributing something also. It's a strategy that's available to everybody. He chose to invest. You can invest also. Sort of like what Jeffrey was saying before. Then the second law that's stated is the one that's directly relevant for us. Rabbi Yehuda also said, he should not reduce the rate. The rate is what I call the sha'ar, the price that's being charged. He shouldn't undercut the going rate, says Rabbi Yehuda. To which the sages respond, in Hebrew it's zachor latov. He's remembered for the good. We'll be really happy if he does that. If he wants to lower the prices, we'll pay less. We're good with that idea. Then the Gemara, commenting on this, asks, what is the logic of the sages? Why do the sages accept this idea that he should be able to lower the price? Because this will cause the rate to broaden. Now, that phrase is an odd phrase. It will cause the rate to broaden. It doesn't mean it's going to lower the price. It means something else. So we're going to have to come back to what exactly they're suggesting here. But they are good with the idea that you can undercut the going rate. Yes?
Your example, you can think of something, a lot of wine situations.
Mm-hmm.
What he did in those.
What Joseph did in Egypt.
7 years in terms of the grain, what he got for the grain. Is there anything written about that in terms of how he priced the grain? Because the barter was for land.
Right.
Essentially. And I. Possibly other goods, because the only ones that were left with property were the priests.
Right.
And many people in Goshen and Pharaoh.
Right. So the answer is yes. There is writing on how Joseph managed it, including secular writing from an economic perspective.
How does that translate to this?
So I don't think it translates directly, because there is not a competition issue. He's the only one with grain. It's a separate question of when you have the monopoly, what is ethical for you to do? That's where this comes into play.
But there's some parallels.
Yeah, quite possibly. If you see some along the way, let me know. So the Code of Jewish Law in source number 6 actually codifies this and says, now we're jumping from Talmudic times in 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th century, we're jumping ahead to the 16th century, Rabbi Yosef Karo, the rabbi who was in Israel writing the Code of Jewish Law, he says, V'chein yachol limkor bezol, one is allowed to sell for less than the going rate, so that people will buy from him, and the other merchants can't prevent it. They can't say, well, that's not fair to us. The philosophy seems to be consumers come first, and there's nothing wrong with you charging less. It's going to benefit the consumers. That's source number one. Source number two on this is what I brought you here in number seven, regarding fair and unfair competition. And here's the story. Hanhu Amorai, there were wool merchants. The Aisu Imra Lefumnara, they brought wool to a place called Pumnara. Pumnara is an Aramaic phrase, it means literally mouth of the river. So clearly what happened was they had wool, they had produced the wool elsewhere, they ship it down the river to this place called Mouth of the River, some port city, and they want to sell it there. But Asu B'nei Masa, local people came along, Kama'ak B'ilavayu, and they tried to prevent them. They said, no, you're undercutting our price for wool. We don't want you to do that here. We don't want the competition. Case comes to Rav Kahana, local authority, and he says, by law, they are able to stop you. He says the local merchants are in fact able to protest and say you can't do this. So we have the first source that said you're remembered for the good when you sell at lower prices. We have the second source that says you're not allowed to compete. But I'm going to jump to source number 8. And source number 8 is a fascinating case. Let me give you a little bit of background on... let me not give you a little bit of background. That's going to be for source number 9. Just kidding. Source number 8, take a look at what Rabbi Isserles writes. He says, Yesh Omrim, some say that the ability of local people to protest against people from elsewhere, like happened with the wool merchants, is only where protecting them like that would not harm consumers. Why? Because the outsiders sell just like the local people sell, and the merchandise is no better. If the outsiders aren't bringing better merchandise and they aren't selling at a lower price, then we protect the local people and say outsiders don't come in. But where they charge less or their merchandise is better so that consumers benefit, then the local merchants can't protest. So what he is telling me, and he's basing it on earlier views, Rabbeinu Yosef Halevi, Rabbeinu Yerucham, he's basing it on earlier views. What he says is, local people are only protected if their merchandise is just as good and their price is just as low as the external merchants who are coming in to compete with them. Otherwise, competition is good. So what emerges from source number 5, with the store owner, and what emerges from source number 8, Rabbi Isserles' ruling in the 16th century, is that competition is good because it helps the consumer. And therefore, if OPEC wants to say, we're going to keep our production levels high, and as a result, prices are going to drop, too bad for the competition. They're within their rights to do so. So far clear?
So I can open up a pizza restaurant next to another one and charge less.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. You can open up your pizza place right next door to whichever pizza place you want to name, and you could undercut them. That's what this sounds like. A remarkable thing, given that I sort of built it up as, well, we're very protective, right? Everybody, that there is an ethical concern. It sounds like there isn't an ethical concern. However, when it came to practice, we found different rulings. Rulings that did not follow that trend. And the first one comes from Rabbi Isserles himself in the case that I wanted to mention before. That indeed is a fascinating case. I'm going to give you a very brief nutshell of it because it's too fascinating to ignore. The printing press emerges in the 15th century, revolutionizing, obviously, publishing, among other things. Jews get heavily into printing and publishing their books right away. In particular, in Italy. In Italy, Italy in general explodes in terms of printing. By the end of the 15th century, just 35 years after Gutenberg has introduced his printing press, you have 77 publishing houses in the Italian provinces alone. And Jews are heavily into it. However, in the middle of the 16th century, the church is very upset about Jews publishing books that they consider to be heretical and anti-Christian, and they take over printing and say, Jews are not allowed to print anymore. If you want to print a Jewish book, it has to be a non-Jewish publisher who's actually going to print it. There's a rabbi named Rabbi Meir of Padua. Rabbi Meir of Padua wants to produce a work including Maimonides' Code of Law and his own commentary on the Code of Law. So he prepares everything. He has money to invest, and he goes to a non-Jewish printer and he says, I'd like you to print this, you know, using my stuff, and I'll pay, you know, to subsidize and so on. And that's what the printer does. Well, there's a competing printer in town who also not a Jewish fellow, but he sees that you can make money on that edition. He copies that edition and brings it to press right afterwards, charging less. As a competing publication. Rabbi Meir of Padua brings this printer, who is not Jewish, to rabbinical court to sue him for copying his work. This is a landmark case in the development of intellectual property, right? Because in Jewish law, you do not have clear-cut intellectual property until this moment in time. You have certain ideas that can sort of be brought in, but no clear-cut. And in secular law, you don't have intellectual property at that point either. You have a good 150, 160 years to go before the Statute of Anne is going to give you protection for creators of intellectual property. There's nothing like that at this point in time. So it's a landmark case, this discussion of what may or may not be done. And Rabbi Isserles is the one who gets this question. He is, at this point, the chief rabbi of Krakow, as well as the second cousin of Rabbi Meir of Padua. So the case comes before him, and he rules mostly in favor of Rabbi Meir of Padua. Not exactly, but mostly in favor of him. And as part of his ruling, one of his reasons for protecting the creator of intellectual property is what I brought you here in source number 9. He quotes a passage out of the Talmud to support his position. He says, Amar Rav Huna, this is a quote that he's bringing from the Talmud. Rav Huna, one of the sages of the Talmud, says, where an alley resident establishes a mill, and what he's talking about, as understood by Rabbi Isserles, is an alley in the sense that it is a road that is enclosed on three sides. So you have your major thoroughfare, and off of that thoroughfare comes an alleyway, which does not have any other entrance, it's a dead end, but people live and have businesses on that alley. So if you imagine for a moment, let's say the major thoroughfare is out there in the lobby, and the table is our alley. And I am sitting right here, and I establish a mill right here in my storefront. And then along comes Harry. No, not Harry, actually. It's not going to be Harry. It's going to be Michael. Along comes Michael, and he says, I want to establish a mill. And he sets it up beside me, but in such a way that people coming in off the road are going to hit his mill first, right? And have no reason to go to mine. And I'm not going to get any traffic from any other direction because the alley is closed. So in that case, Rav Huna said, I may protest. I can say that's not fair because you're now going to draw all of the people who would have come to me. That's a Talmudic passage. So Rabbi Isserles quotes that and says, we see that according to Jewish law, the second printer, in the case of Rabbi Meir of Padua, is not allowed to print this at all because what he's doing is he's harming the livelihood of somebody else. So what he argues is that Jewish law is going to actually prohibit this, even though, look, I'm printing, he's printing. If it costs him more to print, that's his problem. Rabbi Isserles, who is the same one who said that if the external merchants are selling cheaper, you can't stop them, suddenly here says the second printer is allowed to compete with the first one. So the question is, what's going on? You have precedent and Rabbi Isserles' own comments that seem to indicate that we're okay with competition. Now he's saying that you can't compete. The same issue comes up with other responsa. One called Panim Me'irot is dealing with liquor licenses, where there are people who have a liquor license in one town and they're selling for X, and people in the next town get a cheaper license and they want to undercut the price. And the people in the first town are concerned that they're going to lose all of their business. Another case involving Rabbi Moshe Shik, Maharam Shik, also liquor licenses. Those were, as I said before, very common. Now, you'll say to me, yeah.
There's no idea the fact that the second printer and basically stole everything from the first printer. So I mean, whatever he's doing is dishonest from the get-go. It's not a question of pricing. It's
it's dishonesty.
Except that it's an intellectual property. It's just ideas.
Right.
If you're going to tell me that he can't use what he read in the manuscript that Rabbi Meir of Padua put out, then if you leave your notebook on the table, I'm not allowed to copy out your notes from a class? Is that... Today, we have such a concept developed in law. At this point, that's all brand new. So he has four arguments for it. This is only one of the four. The other three weren't directly relevant for us. But there's not, at that stage, there's no such protection of simply saying he's stolen it, because he hasn't. The original is still sitting there. All he's done is taken what he saw and copied it. Yeah, no protection at that stage.
Maybe halachically.
Yeah, correct. No protection.
What about claiming someone's ideas as your own? So he's just reproducing it, but in the author's name.
Right, so that's an issue of dishonesty, right, which we frown on. Plagiarism, right, where you claim, here's a commentary and I just wrote it, right, is dishonest. Is that punishable in court with payment towards the first? Very hard to claim. Very hard to claim. Yeah, unless you could prove damage somehow, and I'm not sure how, what are you going to pay him for? What he did was wrong, but not actionable in court.
No, but the second prince was not saying, well, I will still pay you, Rabbi Meir of Padua, X amount for everything that I produce.
Right, no, he's not paying him a dime.
Right.
Not only that, I mean, the case is even more fascinating than that. It's really a fun, not for Rabbi Meir, but fun for everybody reading about it. It's a fun case because what actually happens is the second printer, when he does this, you know, the front page of the publications, and certainly the Jewish ones in those days, had what's called a frontispiece. It's the opening page. Sharblot is another term that we use for it. But it's on that front page, you say what's inside. So it said, Maimonides' Mishneh Torah, his work of law, along with, we've included this and this, and we've included the commentary of Rabbi Meir of Padua, even though scholars have told us it's terribly inferior and they don't agree with his ideas. But we had to put it in because some people have asked for it. So not only do they copy his work, but they diss him in the process. It's a terrible thing. It's all fresh in my head because I gave a class about it a couple of weeks ago. And if you email me afterwards, there was a sign-in sheet, actually. If people put their email addresses on it, I'll send you a link where you can see information about this case, because it's really remarkable what happened there. But the point that I'm bringing it for is that suddenly Rabbi Yisraelis is saying that certain types of competition are prohibited. My first reaction to prohibiting this would be, well, wait a minute, why should this be prohibited? You're operating within your own turf. Whether it's Michael opening up a mill over there or me operating an oil well, I'm in my own space. Why should this be a problem? How am I? I'm not actively harming him. I'm not going to his property and damaging him. So source number 10 notes that it doesn't matter. I'm not allowed to harm somebody even coming from my own domain. I'm not allowed to. The case in source number 10 is a zoning law, where the Talmud states that if I am soaking flax in my property and my neighbor is growing vegetables next door, and my soaking of flax is somehow damaging his vegetables, it's not clear exactly how, but let's say it is, smell, groundwater, whatever it is, then the rule is I have to move my flax away. If he was growing stuff there first, I am not allowed to introduce a nuisance within a certain distance of his property. That's even though I'm in my own yard. Ditto for growing leek near his onions and so on. They have many other cases. We had quite a bit of zoning law in the Talmud. And another argument that could be brought is I'm not harming him directly. I'm harming him indirectly. I am producing what I'm producing. That's going to lead the price to go down. But that's an indirect result. But we do have a concept of liability in Jewish law for indirect harm. I brought an example of this in source number 11 regarding giving bad advice. Remember that historically you had money changers who were responsible to exchange coins for coins of other material. And there was an issue with coins being valid and recognized. And whether a coin would be accepted wasn't only an issue of who minted it, but it was also the quality of the metal and its weight. And coins erode over time. That's what metal does. So in source number 11, we find a story in which there was a rabbi named Rabbi Chia, rather prominent actually in the Talmud, and a woman showed him a coin. He was considered to be somebody who was an expert in coins. So a woman showed him the coin, and he approved it. He said, yeah, that's a valid coin. And she the deal with her was she was selling something and someone had offered her this coin to pay for it. She wanted to know, is this a valid coin? So she takes the coin thinking it's valid. The next day she goes back to Rabbi Chiya and says, you know, I showed this coin to other people and they rejected it. So I am out money because I accepted a coin on your say-so. And Rabbi Chiya told Rav, who is another sage with him, exchange it for her. Give her a good coin in exchange for it from my from my treasury. It's a bad deal. What am I going to do? And the truth is, as the Talmud continues there, he's actually not responsible due to other considerations, but again, I wanted to fit everything on one page, so I didn't bring the whole story. But he was going beyond the letter of the law by taking care of her needs here. But the fundamental point is, there is a concept of liability, even for indirect harm, like where I gave bad advice. It was her choice whether to follow it or not. Nonetheless, I am held responsible. So, what emerges from these rulings, on especially the liquor license cases, is that if there is a shahar, where there is a going rate, you're not allowed to undercut. And it's not about how much you're going to undercut by, like there's a certain zone that's okay. In the interest of time, I didn't bring you all the literature on that, but no, it's even a small bit of undercutting is prohibited. As long as there is a shahr, as long as there is a rate that's recognized, you're not allowed to. And so now I have to ask the key question. We're now 40 minutes in, I'm getting to the key question.
What's the shahr maximum?
Yes, the shahr technically in Roman times referred to a maximum rate, but where there is a price that everybody is doing, I'm also using the term shahr for that. Thank you for pointing it out. I should have noted that. What we've now set up is that on the one hand, we have sources that say, we saw them, they're Talmudic, that say competition is good, it's going to help the consumer, go for it. And it was pretty explicit. And then we have latter-day responsa that seem to throw those out the window and say, no, we're not going to allow you to compete in that way. You're harming somebody else. Like the example that I brought you from Rabbi Yisraelis. So the question is, where do we say that, in fact, competition is permitted? And where do we say competition is prohibited? We have to find a way to reconcile the earlier precedent with the later rulings, because it is axiomatic within Jewish legal tradition that later authorities cannot simply contradict what the Talmud says. They have to take it into consideration in order to come up with their rulings. They may say it doesn't apply in a particular case, but that logic has to be argued. So that's our question here. What is, and the answer is, at least what I've come up with, is that what it's about fundamentally is a balance of rights between competing merchants, where we can reasonably anticipate that one's actions are going to harm the other, who has the greater right to engage in business there? Is there one who has a greater right than the other? Meaning, by default, we favor competition that will benefit customers. That's a general rule, as we've already seen. However, if one merchant wants to engage in an action which is going to harm another one, he has to first ask himself the following question. Number one, do I have a diminished right compared to his right to engage in this activity? Or perhaps, does he have an amplified right to special protection that I don't have? In other words, is this an equal playing field or not? That's really what this comes down to. And now I'm going to explain what I mean by that by giving examples. Number one, a diminished right to engage in this competitive activity. The first and easiest case is the outsider. If you have somebody who is local and is engaged in this business, and then somebody's going to come in from some other community, like the wool merchants that we saw, they have a diminished right to engage in this activity. That's the first rule that I'm going to propose. I'm not inventing this myself. Right, Moses Nachmanides, writing in the 13th century in Spain, offered this idea in source number 12. He says, "Mi she'ein lo leire le'umnut," one who does not have the right to enter this craft, meaning somebody who, if all other things were equal, we would say to him, "Get out! You're in this case here, you're not local, and therefore you don't have the right to compete." He's not given the right now because he will have a good effect on the rate. If the residents wish it to be cheaper, Let them set the rate accordingly. They are entitled within their community to have a town council, and they can decide what merchants can and can't charge. Or they can establish competition from among their own citizens. They can set up somebody else to compete. If they feel someone has a monopoly and he's harming people, so let them set up someone from their own. The fact that you are charging less does not entitle you to come in and compete. That's not Maimonides' position. The outsider has a diminished right to compete. You follow? I'm not asking if you agree or not, but you follow the principle that he's suggesting. Local people are given preference, and the fact that the price is going to be lower doesn't change that. That's one. Second case of a diminished right is where the goal is not to make money, but rather to harm the other person. But that's really what you're trying to accomplish. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 13, here's the ideal example. Before we read number 13, if you're familiar with the biblical case of the story of Sodom. Sodom was a city which was known for cruelty. That emerges from the biblical text as well as rabbinic explanations of that text. They were known for being very cruel to others. So when the Talmud wants to describe somebody as being cruel, that's the case that they bring as an example, is the city of Sodom. And so here, in source number 13, we get the following. A guy buys land right next door to his father's land. Then his father at some point passes away. He and his siblings are now dividing up the estate. And he says, do me a favor, let my portion be right next to this other land that I own. It'll be easier for me with all my equipment and my work, and it makes sense. And they say, no, we don't want to do it. Why? It doesn't change anything for them. The land there is no better than other land. It's no more convenient for them than other land. It's spite because, you know, we're in an accounting firm. You've seen this in families. This is what happens. People who don't get along, you end up with problems. And just out of spite, they're gonna take this stand. So, what he said, Rabbah, the sage in this particular passage says, is in a case like this, we compel them not to act in the manner of Sodom. You can't be cruel to somebody else. What you're doing is not business. What you're doing is violence. That happens to be in the context of making money, but that's not really what it's about. And so, in the event that somebody's goal is just to harm the other, and in source number 14, I brought you from the work Erech Shai, Rabbi Shlomo Yehuda Tabak. You can read it there. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip reading it aloud. But where the person's goal is simply, I want to harm the other guy, it's prohibited. Which is why, if you flip back for a second to the other side, source number 6, when Rabbi Caro approved competition, he said, one is allowed to sell for less than the going rate so that people will buy from him. If your goal is to gain customers, then it's okay. If your goal is, I want to drive the other guy out, I want to harm him, that's another story. Now, the truth is, it's more complicated than that. I'm going to come back to that, but I want to just set up the framework of the positions here. Where the competitor who's going to undercut has less of a right to compete, either because he's an outsider or because what he's doing is really an act of aggression, not an act of business, then he's not given the right to do this. We don't acknowledge his right to compete in this way. Clear? I'm giving you a lot of information very quickly. Are we all right? Okay. I know I'm dealing with smart people, so it's just a lot of stuff. But the second type is where the person who charges more has an amplified right to protection. And there are two types that I want to talk about. Number one is what's called in Talmudic terms, ani hamahapech v'charara. What it means is a pauper who is pursuing a cake. And what it's talking about is the following. You have somebody who is indigent, and he doesn't have great means. And then there's an opportunity for him to get an asset of some kind, and he's pursuing it. I come along, and I am a person of means, and I grab his item. But it's not his yet. He didn't actually get to it. I see he's pursuing it, and I grab it away before he can get to it. But I am not as needy as he is. He has the right to special protection. This rule of ani hamahapech b'charara applies. He has the ability to get protected from competition like me, and therefore, I'm not allowed to take it away. So if you take a look, for example, in source number 15, we get this story of which I only wrote part here. Rav Gittel is one of the sages. He's trying to acquire a certain plot of land. Another sage buys it first. Rav Gittel complains to a third authority, Rabbi Zeira, who complained to yet another authority, Rabbi Yitzchak Nafka, goes up the chain. Rabbi Yitzchak Nafka goes back to Rabbi Abba, who had purchased it, and said, "What are you doing? You don't have the right to take that away from him. He wanted that land." And and Rabbi Abba agrees. And they asked him, "So why'd you do it?" He said, "I didn't know." And the way the story plays out, Rabbi Abba, who had bought the land, says, "I'm willing to give it to him as a gift. I don't want to sell it to him, I want to give it as a gift. Because it's bad, whatever you want to call it, it's a bad omen if the first land that you buy, you have to sell off. So I want to give it to him as a present." Rabbi Gittel refuses, because he says, "I don't take gifts. There's a biblical verse, one who hates gifts will live. So I don't want to accept the gift." And neither of them takes the land, and the land becomes known as the land of the sages. And no one farms it, and it just sits there vacant, because the two sages can't figure out what to do. But they're being generous, that's the nice way to say it. But the point is that there is an idea of protection for a needy person, and this is in fact codified in Jewish law. And therefore, the argument could go, if the merchant who's going to suffer because of the low prices is somebody who's entitled to protection as a needy person, then I'm not allowed to undercut him. If all things were equal, it would be fine. But we have protections for certain populations to make sure that they're going to be all right. And this is indeed brought by various authorities. What about if I... Well, all right, I'm going to leave the what if. The last argument for the right of special protection is a more extreme case. What if my lowering the price is actually going to cause somebody to go belly up, to not survive? It's not just that it's going to be harmful, but he's actually going to go broke. So here I go back to the point that I made in the beginning. Go back to source number 5, where the sages said, the reason why you're allowed to sell less than somebody else is because you're going to cause the rate to broaden. And I ask then, what does the rate broadening mean? So now we're finally able to explain it. It's in source number 17, but I'll explain it outside of the text. There are two different ways in which the price becomes high. One way the price becomes high is if there's no supply, right? So there's very little to choose from, and therefore the price is going to go up. Another way, though, is if people are hoarding supply. And apparently that was very common, that people would simply hoard the supply, so there's less on the market, and that's the way the price would go up. In such a circumstance, if I lower my price, then what's going to happen? The market will broaden, meaning that these people who have less of a profit margin now will come down to meet my price, and they'll simply sell more of what they have. They'll open up their warehouse, they'll sell more of what they have, and that will cause the market to broaden. There will be more supply now, and they won't go out of business. Now, the truth is that's not the only potential economic result. If they can wait it out, they may keep hoarding their stuff and wait for the market to improve. But that's the assumption here, is your prices are now going to drop, and everybody will be able to compete. And that's why it's okay back in source number 5. You could do that, you could compete, because in the end, everybody will drop down to the same level and it'll be good. But if it's going to drive somebody out of business, then you're not allowed to. He is entitled to special protection. So what emerges from that is that this is the argument. In general, we're very happy with low prices. They help consumers, whatever the impact on broader society may be. However, where the victim of the lowered prices is entitled to special protection, he's a pauper, or he's going to go broke, or where the person who is going to lower the prices doesn't have the right to compete because he's an outsider coming in from some other place, or because what he's doing is not an act of commerce, it's an act of violence to somebody, then we say you're not entitled to lower the prices. And in fact, you could be taken to rabbinical court for this, again, assuming we were dealing with a case in which everybody was actually answerable to rabbinical court. Taking this now and applying it to the OPEC case, We recognize that there is no fixed rate that we're working with today, but the philosophical principles are the point. It's very hard to argue for a diminished right to compete for OPEC, meaning that there's no concept of local and elsewhere when you're dealing with a global market. I could buy my oil from Canada. I could buy my oil from around the world. And there are means of, we're all competing within the same market. There's no such concept as local in this regard. In terms of saying, is their goal violence or is their goal business, it's true that what they're doing is they're trying to drive out competition as part of this. But that's not the only motivation. Part of the motivation, as I mentioned back in source number one with the article from Vox, part of it is about retaining market share. Recognizing that if they cut their production, then people who want oil are going to go elsewhere. And that's what happened to Saudi Arabia in the 80s. So therefore, it's not entirely an act of violence, it's partly an act of business. You follow? So therefore, I don't think that they can be charged as being unethical in that right. What about the argument that their competitors have an enhanced right of protection? Well, it's a hard thing to call an oil producer indigent. Maybe the argument would be you're going to drive them out of business. Maybe that's an argument you could bring. And under that, maybe Jewish law would say, once you push them that far, then you have to stop. You can't drive them out of business in order to do this. In sum, what we've said, and like we said quite a bit, but what we said is we do have a history within Jewish tradition of going with the community's benefit, and if there are lower prices, we view that as positive for the community. We have responsa that actually limited competition. And the justification for limiting competition is either where the person who's going to undercut has less right to be in the market in the first place, such as where he is from elsewhere, or where those who are going to suffer by this have a right to protection, such as where they are indigent. That's the two-second summary. I'm going to conclude my remarks with one very fast story. And then if people want to stick around and ask questions, that's great. I do plan also for those who signed in, I'll send out a link with the information about Rabbi Meir of Padua and the link to the recording for this as well. The sign-in sheet, I see one over there. I think there were two.
There are two.
Okay, thanks. The story is as follows. This year is what's called in Hebrew a Shemitah year. It's a sabbatical year. And what that means is that every 7 years, the land of Israel is not supposed to be farmed. It's a biblical law that's supposed to be left fallow, people rest, the fields are open, anybody can come in and take. That's the sabbatical year. But actually, come to think of it, I didn't need to introduce that for this story. Sorry, I got sidetracked. The story goes this way. Forget the sabbatical year. It's important for another time. But here's the story that is germane. This goes on in south-central Poland, in Radomsk, in the middle of the 19th century. There is a shortage of grain. The grain is in short supply, the price goes up. A group of Hasidim in Radomsk take all their money, and they leverage and borrow money, in order to invest in grain. They want to buy as much grain as they can get a hold of. And they put everything into it. And then, once they've fully leveraged themselves, they're all invested in grain, shipment of grain comes down the river. And what happens to the price of grain? Six. They're going to go broke. They're going to lose everything that they just plowed into grain. They go to the Rebbe, right, the spiritual leader of the Radomsker Hasidic group, and they say to him, Rebbe, you have to pray for us. We're going to go broke. And he says, why should I pray? What do you mean? The price of grain is low. And they say to him, yeah, but we're going to starve. So he says to them what I brought you in the last source on the sheets. He says to them, no, my masters, we don't pray for food that has become cheaper. You don't turn to God and say, please make food more expensive. And we don't ask for mercy regarding a surplus of good. He says, put your minds at rest. The one who aided the poor provided them with food when prices were high. So he'll help and support you now when prices are low. His response is, we view this as a universal good when the prices are low. And we're not going to turn to God and ask him to raise the prices. I bring the story because it's a cute story, but also because it helps underscore this idea that low prices in general are considered good and therefore are licensed, barring the special circumstances that I mentioned. Thank you very much again, Jonathan. Thank you for setting this up. I will stay here to answer questions, but we're already just about at the 1 hour mark, so those who have to go, feel free to go. Harry.